You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
G'day listeners, welcome to episode 9 of The Dead Prussian podcast. I'm your host Mick, and today I have a very innovative topic for you. I'd like to firstly thank everyone for their support on social media, especially on the multiple platforms that we are releasing the podcast on now. So make sure you check out your Libsyn podcast app, your SoundCloud podcast app. We're also on Stitcher, and you can find us on Podbean as well. For all those people who have been chatting to us on Twitter, it's been great keeping track of everyone who's been picking up on some of the musical choices I use for this podcast. I'll let everyone know it hasn't changed all 8 episodes. So those people who've asked me, what is your new music? It's the same as the old music, and it's in the credits at the end. All right, for those who are interested, please leave us a review on iTunes. The more reviews you leave us on iTunes, the more I can go ahead and get out to a broader audience. And that's the aim of this podcast, is to discuss war and warfare, the important topics therein, and reach a broad audience. You do not even have to give us a written review. I welcome all feedback. However, if you want to just provide us 5 stars, 4 stars, 3 stars, that's fine. Being a little bit cheap if you provide us only 1 or 2 stars. And the final announcement, the blog on the deadprussian.com has gone live. It's called The War Diary. It is a summation of what we do to put the show together and any of the interesting lessons we have learned in the previous month, week, episode. We've also got the War College that's coming out. It's slowly being rolled out. I've put it up for a preview. It's still under construction, but on there you'll find some interesting references. Right, that's enough of me talking to myself. Tonight I have a great guest, and I say tonight because it's night time for me, but it's not night time for my guest. I'm speaking with Dr. Amy Fox-Godden. She's a teaching fellow in the history of warfare at the University of Birmingham. G'day, Amy. How are you going?
I'm good, thanks, Mick. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very excited about the topic we're going to discuss. If the people didn't get my pun at the start, they will get it now. We're discussing innovation and change in the British military in World War One. So, Amy, you're a bit of a specialist in this area. What sort of got you into studying the history of warfare and, in particular, innovation and change in the British military in World War One?
Well, it's really, how long have you got? I came to military history, the history of warfare, in quite a personal respect. So a number of my family members were killed on the Western Front in the First World War. So that really sparked my interest, as it were. And initially had a real interest in the administrative side of the military. So actually what staff officers do and how civilians could translate their skills into a military context. And I think it was that relationship between civil and military skills that really got me involved. The innovation thing came from a slightly different angle. It actually came from my previous career before I came back to academia. The company I was working for was going through something called transformation, a word that's very familiar to a lot of military innovation scholars.
Yeah.
We had a number of consultants coming in, change agents, I think they badged themselves as.
Which is different to FBI agents. So Mulder and Scully were FBI agents, not change agents. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, and they were infinitely cooler as well. So we had a number of consultants coming in. They were trying to overhaul our company's culture, what we were doing. But being on the coalface, it was very frustrating, actually, carrying out localized innovations and not having a way of feeding those up to the people who are making decisions. And so in a way, I combined my working experience with my kind of historical interest and came up with this idea of, well, the British Army is such an incredibly large institution during the First World War. How does it deal with some of these problems? And that's kind of where I got started, really. The stakes are so much higher in a wartime. We hear about successful individuals, but I wanted to see whether they were the norm or an exception to the rule. So yeah, that's how I got started.
That's an interesting path to where you've found yourself teaching the history of warfare at the University of Birmingham, when you've, I suppose a corporate culture has driven you to study the military culture from almost a corporate angle. And our topic today is learning and change in the British Army in the First World War, as I've mentioned. And look, I'm one of these people that kind of expects the military back then to have been some sort of fixed mindset, simply because when I read the history books, we saw a long time of very similar tactics. You know, there was very static, defensive trench warfare occurring on the Western Front. It didn't feel, when I was an undergrad studying this stuff, that there was, you know, a change agent, whether it be Mulder or Scully, in the British Army at the time, or even in any of the Western allies, or even on the German side. We started to see some innovation towards the end. But can you give us a quick overview of the culture of the British Army in particular, whether or not the culture was one homogenous, innovative culture, or was it one homogenous, change-resistant culture, or was it something more complex?
It's definitely the million-dollar question there, and unfortunately we haven't got much time to go into it, but I can, of course, give you an overview. I think some of the things to bear in mind with the British Army is it has to be prepared to fight anywhere in the globe. It has an imperial policing duty. It has to balance that with the, I suppose, danger or reality of having to fight a continental enemy as well. So what you see with the British Army is that by necessity, it has to put forward a pragmatic view. It can't, I suppose, prioritise prescription over principles. So what you're seeing here is a real kind of case of flexibility out of necessity. What I would say, and I want to caveat this, I suppose, in a way, is that I do think that there is a culture of innovation running through the British Army in the lead up and during the First World War. But there are many different cultures as well. Not all officers are thinking officers. Some very much enjoy the social side of the military, you know, sipping a gin and tonic on the veranda, say. And to be honest, that social side is not completely at odds with this culture of innovation. In fact, you know, the club culture, pre-existing relationships are really important to learning and innovation. I'm sure we see it in the modern military today. It's much easier to get in touch with your mates than it necessarily is going through a massive SOP kind of manual. So there's a culture of innovation, yes, but this isn't homogenous. There are kind of social cultures running through there as well. There's this idea that the British Army is something of a learning organisation, which is, you know, a kind of very management jargon term. And I'm not really sure whether it's a helpful analogy for the British Army. I think broadly speaking, the culture of the British Army is one that's receptive to new ideas and innovations, particularly in wartime. But I think that's because it's possible to cut through the red tape. And you have individuals who are willing to do that and in a position to do that as well. So on the whole, I think the Army is pretty good at listening to dissenters. It promotes self-reliance, partly out of necessity. And I think where appropriate, it's willing to kind of subvert or challenge that chain of command. But I want to caveat that and say that change by its very nature is unsettling. And you do get pockets of inertia and scepticism as well.
And that's how a lot of consultants make their money, with the change management process. So what I take from that is there were disruptive thinkers, and that interpersonal human networks, you know, whether or not it's a conversation over a G&T in the mess, or if it is knowing someone who was particularly good at something and it might help you out in your particular spot, is a way of generating innovation. That requires disruptive thinkers, and we've talked about change agents a lot, and I won't make any more references to the world's most famous FBI agents apart from that one. So who were the change agents in the British Army at the time? Are they known? I mean, you know, was it Field Marshal Haig? Was he one? Or was it just some lower order officer? Or who were the change agents? And more importantly, how did they innovate, and how did they encourage innovation?
Well, there's a number of them. I think, you know, we've aware probably of some of the more famous ones. I wouldn't say that Haig himself is a change agent. I'd suggest that actually he's, to use some more management term, I'm really sorry, is more of a project sponsor. So there needs to be buy-in from the top of the army.
A project sponsor, just to unpack that for a second, is that like an entrepreneur, or is that what we would see being more of a project management role, like facilitator, provides them the leverage that they need? Is that what a sponsor is?
I think there are kind of three characteristics or characters I think that need to be in place to make change work. And I'm, you know, shamelessly using Michelle Goyer's really useful model of change and innovation.
Okay.
So you have your experts and your innovators. So for instance, someone like Sir Eric Geddes, who overhauls transportation, a civilian coming in and overhauling transportation, but without the buy-in from an entrepreneur to smooth over administration, then that change isn't going to work. So you have your experts and innovators, you have your entrepreneurs, and then you have your project sponsors that are usually high-ranking generals, or in some cases, Haig himself. So to give you another example, an individual called Ivor Maxey, preeminent trainer of troops, is kind of handpicked to set up an inspectorate of training in 1918. The problem with the British Army is that training is very much an individual commander's responsibility. So you get some guy at the top of the organisation telling you how to train your troops. It's not going to go down very well. So what you then have is an entrepreneur, and that can be in the form of a staff officer. And in this case, it was an individual called Guy Dornay, who did a lot of work in legitimising what Maxey was trying to do. And then at the top, you have Douglas Haig, who is authorising and driving this along. So I suppose when I talk about change agents in my work and when I lecture, I'm always at pains to state that they work within a broader network. So there's an interdependence of individuals that allow that change agent's ideas to take root. And, you know, it does need some kind of institutional buy-in. You can have people who are disruptive, but if they're just going to make a nuisance of themselves and it's not going to be legitimised, then these innovations won't take root. I suppose with someone like Eric Geddes, who's a civilian, as opposed to someone like Maxey, who's a professional soldier, they come from very different backgrounds, but both of them face a certain degree of friction and scepticism. So it's not just about an outsider coming in, challenging the way things are done.
Right, so that's very interesting I'm going to say strata of change agents. I might trademark that just in case someone tries to steal that. There's lots of people out there with MBAs who listen to this podcast. It's probably not true. There's probably not lots of people who listen to this podcast. I generally don't tell my guests that until I've already got them on the show, though. I'm interested the way that you've explained the three types of change agents and where they might sit in the organisation. To me, it sounds like there very much was grassroots innovation. And I guess we understand that, you know, peacetime bureaucratic armies are famous for their red tape, but when the friction of war hits a military force, there becomes a fluidity or flexibility, especially at the lower orders. But there also seems that, you know, with project sponsors, as you mentioned, there seems to be innovation that was from the top as well. So obviously, you know, on the Western Front, there was a need to do something other than, you know, as Blackadder suggests, do the same tactic 17 times. Was it more grassroots or was it more driven from the top?
That's a difficult question. Am I allowed to fence it on this one, or do I have to come down on one side or the other?
No, you can fence it. I'm just impressed I asked a difficult question.
I think, if I'm honest, I think we can probably get a little bit too carried away with, you know, this idea of a top-down or a bottom-up approach. You know, I don't know if having a vectored approach, which I suppose you could call it, is particularly useful. What I do think is that there is a definite interplay between the two approaches. And I think work by people like Raphael Marcus at King's College London and Nina Collars have been really helpful in I suppose, getting us to think about it in that particular way. I think in the British Army, there is very much an ethos that promotes innovation, and that I think there's a tolerance, if not an active promotion, of creativity in there too. So what I would suggest is that there needs to be something more, something to do with the common character of the military that enables innovation to take root, whether that's from the top down or the bottom up. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive by any means. But what I do think is interesting, and part of the problem is actually codifying and institutionalizing the innovations that are coming up from the grassroots. And I don't think this is so much the resistance of, you know, your elite generals or people at the top of the military. I think sometimes it's to do with the sheer amount of information and the experience that's generated. I mean, it was a problem in the First World War, and I can only imagine that that's tenfold in the modern military today. I mean, how do you discern what the right lesson is? And in a way, I think that's where the British Army, at least, where its pragmatism, where its flexibility actually really comes in handy, is that there's an encouragement for formations and individuals to use their initiative. And I think in a way, this is why you can see so many innovations coming from the front line or from civilian experts themselves that end up being institutionalized. So two aspects of artillery, for example, flash spotting and sound ranging are pioneered by civilians, and they're being bought in by mid-level managers and then backed by senior generals. So again, tying into this change agency idea as well, that actually you need buy-in from all levels of command, not just the bottom and the top. So, you know, that's not to say there's not friction. That's not to say there isn't inertia. Of course there is, but it's not to the point where it paralyzes the organization into maintaining the status quo. But, you know, the army's not homogenous. There are pockets of stupidity and skepticism in there, unfortunately.
So for a fence-sitting question, that was an excellent response, particularly if you can get artillery into any conversation. I'm a fan. Now, that sounds like there was also a lot of problems similar to the big data issues we're experiencing now in any aspect of life. Because that could take us down a rabbit hole, I'm going to move on, and I'm going to ask a question that I actually didn't send you or have you prepare for. Why? Because I'm not that good at this hosting thing, but it is a question close to my Antipodean heart. Now, the AIF, they were around some of these places where innovation was important, such as the, you know, water purification, water sourcing was one of the key innovations you've talked about elsewhere. But not on this show, so I won't mention elsewhere until after this episode. What was innovation like in the AIF? If you know, if you don't know, then feel free to tell me where to go.
The AIF, innovation in the AIF is incredibly important, but, and I'm afraid I'm going to strike at the heart of, you know, the Antipodean love of the AIF here, is that the AIF is very much dependent on the British Army for a lot of its pre-war training.
Never.
You get a lot of individuals. I know, it's terrible, isn't it? I feel like I've shattered the hearts of many Australian listeners.
A colonial army reliant on their colonial gendarmerie masters. That's all right.
Oh, I feel terrible now. So they send over a lot of individuals to, you know, because the CMF is quite a nascent force. It's not long after Federation. And so you have a number of British Imperial officers coming over and kind of disseminating their ways of doing things. Now, of course, you know, I don't think it can be argued that the AIF wasn't in some way a core elite. They are incredibly proficient when it comes to innovation. But I would suggest that that's just, you know, part of a wider culture of innovation running throughout the various expeditionary forces. You know, we think about the Australians, primarily at Gallipoli, their exploits, particularly during the 100 Days Offensive of 1918 on the Western Front. But they're also doing excellent things out in the Palestine theatre as well, where they're not put in a kind of a homogenous core, that actually a lot of Australian formations are dotted about various corps and formations out in Palestine. So this idea about their homogeneity even as being a reason for why they're so innovative, I don't think really stands up to scrutiny. But I think really what you see with the AIF is a kind of a subculture within the British Army at this time. I just want to kind of caveat that, is that this idea of initiative and flexibility is really stark. But that's not to say that British formations don't do something similar. And I think, you know, the British get a little bit of a bad reputation when compared to the Australians in the First World War, but they're all working from the same military pamphlets. They're all benefiting from the same school systems. And of course, Australian forces did benefit from a number of Imperial staff officers to, you know, kind of smooth over initial administrative issues before you start getting exceptional people like Jess coming in, Blamey, for example, in order to take over the reins from their Imperial officers.
Yeah, I think we won't touch on the myths surrounding Gallipoli, and you know, people forget there are a lot of British soldiers that were there as well. Because this isn't Mythbusters, this is the Dead Prussian. So we will move on to the next question so that I don't face a lynch mob when I go out about busting any myths on the AIF. But it is interesting to see those expeditionary forces in the context of the broader Western militaries. What interests me is that pretty much since that time, we've seen very much a coalition of Western militaries. I mean, probably going back to the Napoleonic Wars when we had the coalitions then. One militaries work together. We learn from each other. There are changes that need to be made in one that may affect another. So for a modern military, what are the key lessons about innovation and change that they can take from World War One and the British experience?
Okay. I think in a way, I mean, I suppose I'm going to limit my comments really to the British military, but I suppose in a way they could be applicable more broadly, is that I think the British military is attempting to put some of these ideas into practice. Something like the Lessons Exploitation Centre, for example, is really an attempt to discern best practice lessons and try and find a way of codifying them. There's also, particularly in the two recent conflicts that the British have been involved in, that you have a kind of handover session between brigades that are on rotation. So it's a way of passing over, you know, their experience, their lessons that they've learned in theatre to the next lot that are going to be going over there. And you can, I suppose, harking back to something I said earlier about, you know, mates getting in contact with each other about things. There are examples of officers who are about to deploy to Afghanistan calling their friend who they met at Sandhurst, asking for, you know, what's the lie of the land? What do I need to know? And this is such a natural tendency in all walks of life. You know, it's much easier to have a conversation over a cup of coffee about what things work and what things don't than consulting your company's manual, which is, you know, the size of a kind of tombstone. It's just a very human trait. But the problem with this is that it makes it really difficult to capture innovations. And a lot of scholars who are working on the modern military have raised concerns around what they've called adaptation traps. So the fact that a lot of these informal conversations are happening, how do you capture those? And so I think a lot of the problem is down to a need to have a multiple variety of different contexts to do that. And I know that the British military has its own kind of online, you know, way of sharing lessons. I know the American military does as well. But I think, you know, kind of generating more context where that can happen, whether that's in a First World War sense, there are a lot of conferences, there are a lot of training schools, there were conferences after training schools, writing doctrine and pamphlets by committee. You know, there's a myriad of different ways of doing this. And I think, you know, a problem does come down to the sheer amount of information that's generated. And again, how do you know that that lesson is the right one to propagate throughout the whole military? And this is obviously not something that's new. This has dogged the British military in particular from, I'd say, the late 19th to the early 20th century. So some ways are more effective than others. And, you know, obviously I'm very conscious that I've gone around the houses in response to this question, is I think the military is probably doing the best that it can. But there is, of course, you know, ways of improving that. But unfortunately, I probably don't have any suggestions how that might be the case other than providing those different contexts and methods to capture information and test ways that that might be useful.
Yeah, I mean, the stark reality is that, you know, the most important lessons that militaries learn are often learnt in blood, and having a means to capture those lessons means that we might save blood at some stage in the future. Very interesting topic. However, every guest who comes on this show must pay their penance. I'm not sure what they're repenting, but they must pay their penance. And it is the final question I ask every guest. I will start a sentence and I will ask you to finish the sentence for me because sometimes I get a little stuck. And this harks back to what we're trying to do here on the Dead Prussian podcast, and that is define war in as many different ways as possible, because that's what Big Carl did in his weighty tome on war. So, Amy, the sentence is, war is... Please continue.
I think war is as much a conflict with the enemy as it is with a force's own culture, its own bureaucracy, and its own ways of working. And I think what war does is it requires forces to reflect on and, if necessary, challenge traditional methods and preconceptions. And I think that, in a way, strikes at the heart of military innovation and change in the military.
That was an excellent answer. Of course, the correct answer is that war is the continuation of policy by other means. So unfortunately, I won't have you on the show again. No, I'm just kidding. It is good to have an answer that is not your standard Clausewitz answer, or all those people who listening who gave me Clausewitz answers. You are on notice. Amy, thank you very much for coming on the show. Innovation is something that, particularly in Australia, for those who haven't heard, the government is leading the ideas boom. It's a year of innovation, and it's a perpetual program that the current government is looking to instill in Australian culture. So innovation is quite a key topic in Australia at the moment. I think military innovation has a lot of people fascinated, particularly when we can look back at history and see how did they learn from what they were doing, and did they learn well, as opposed to did they just do well at their actual jobs. So thank you very much for coming on.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. All right, to all our other guests and listeners out there, we are still short on iTunes reviews. I've just had a check whilst I've been recording this interview, and no one has taken my advice. One, because you haven't heard the interview yet. However, you still on notice, I need iTunes reviews, because they help us get out there. We were lucky enough to be featured in the top 10 of the new and noteworthy news and politics podcasts on iTunes for Australia. I'm not sure why it's news and politics. I think I should compete with the history buffs, but maybe it's easier to compete with anyone who's sprouting Donald Trumpisms at the moment. So thank you very much for listening, ladies and gents. And until next time, crack a book.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons attribution license. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.